A man with no face stares at me from the corner of a room. He pleads for help, but I'm afraid to move. He begins to cry. It is a pitiful sound, and it sickens me. He screams, but as I awaken, I realize the screams are mine.
That's Eric Fair, reading from an editorial he wrote for the Washington Post several months ago. He has had those nightmares since his stint in Iraq. In 2004, he was an interrogator for the military. Here in the U.S., he'd been a police officer, but he left for health reasons, and he was snapped up by the Army. He found himself in Abu Ghraib. He didn't have any special expertise in interrogation. Eric Fair was given 2 days of cursory training and then sent into the cells. He was one of the few who spoke Arabic.
It was a great way to go into the booth, into the interrogation room, and speak with the Iraqis and use my language. And my accent was terrible, my vocabulary was horrible, and they would laugh, and it was a good way to just sort of open the door. But the more that we spoke to, the more we realized that our job really was to decide who was innocent and who was guilty. Not necessarily what intelligence they had, but did they even belong at Abu Ghraib?
And innocent and guilty of what?
Many of them had been captured because they were suspected insurgents, and that could mean just about anything. That could mean they were suspected of hiding a mortar round in their backyard. It could mean that they were suspected of setting an IED on the side of the road, or they could be running a cell.
So was it very difficult to figure out who was guilty and who wasn't?
It was nearly impossible. It was impossible. Lots of interrogators had techniques that they thought that they could understand whether a detainee was lying, whether they looked down at the floor when they were speaking, or whether they blinked their eyes a certain amount of times, or whether they looked nervous. But so many things were going in Abu Ghraib. We were being shot at, mortars were coming, and rockets were coming, and that everyone was nervous. So it was impossible to understand whether a detainee was nervous because he was lying, whether he was nervous because here he was in Abu Ghraib, this famous prison of Saddam Hussein, or whether he was just nervous because he was guilty.
So what would happen when you went beyond the conversation?
I'm not sure what you mean by beyond the conversation.
In terms of techniques for getting information.
Well, it was frustrating. Here we were in this prison complex, and we were being shot at, and our friends were being killed outside the wire. And here we were speaking to these Iraqis who potentially had information that could stop that. And no one was cooperating. And whether that was because they were innocent or because they simply weren't talking was impossible to tell. Where things started to get out of control were in places like the hard site, where they put what were called high-value detainees, men who they believed had very important information about the insurgency. And that's where people started to use certain techniques like sleep deprivation and stress positions and all the things that we've heard about and seen in the media. And once they started to experiment with these techniques, things just sort of spiraled out of control.
And what did you think at the time?
Taken out of context, and just in this nice, safe studio that I'm sitting, it all sounds very disgusting and harsh. But inside that prison, quite possibly one of the worst places I've ever seen and hope to never see anything like it, some of it seemed, I don't want to use the word normal, but in some ways it seemed appropriate. We were at war. We were being asked to get information. We weren't being told that these things were wrong. It's not as if this stuff was being done behind closed doors. Military officers were there. People were witnessing these things. So to make a judgment call at that time was difficult.
But eventually, Eric Fair did make a judgment. His turning point came when he was sent to an interrogation facility in Fallujah. He went from being a witness to being a participant.
And I was sent to what they called a DIF, Division Interrogation Facility, assigned to the 82nd Airborne in Fallujah. And that was a much smaller operation, and it was there was less oversight in a place like Fallujah. And so some of the techniques that we had used or people that had used at Abu Ghraib, whether it was sleep deprivation or the stress positions, it was much easier to use those things in a place like Fallujah. In a specific incident, I was asked to assist in a sleep deprivation of a detainee. I was on a 12-hour shift. I was on the night shift. And I came in during the evening, and one of my fellow interrogators asked me to help keep this guy awake during the night. I was going to his cell every hour, strip him naked, keep him awake for a few minutes, and then let him go back to sleep. And I did this for about 3 or 4 hours. And by that third or fourth hour, I recognized that I crossed a line that I had not wanted to cross. It was, you know, quite possibly the worst failure in my life. I was disgusted with myself. And I recognized at that point that I simply wanted nothing to do with interrogation. It wasn't working, and it wasn't something I wanted to be a part of.
And you just mentioned that it wasn't working. A lot of people have said that, well, while we don't like these techniques, waterboarding and the like, these stress positions, sleep deprivation, et cetera, that, well, this is the way to get information from people.
It may or may not be, but that really has nothing to do with my point of view here. It's just a question of values. This is not the way we should do things. if abusive interrogation produced intelligence, that's not an answer for why we should do it. I often heard that when we were in Iraq that we should allow the Iraqis, the former Iraqi Republican Guard types, to conduct these interrogations because they knew how to do these interrogations. They knew how to get information. We're better than that. We're in Iraq to show these people how to run a democracy, how to live in a free world, and we are to be their standard. It's not to be the other way around. I've always been and will continue to be willing to lay my life down for this country, whether it was with the Army or the police department. But I will not lay down those values. And so I'm willing to go ahead and accept maybe less information as long as we behave to the standards that we should.
What has been the reaction from the public and from the military to your editorial that was published in the Washington Post back in February?
I would say 60% to 70% have been supportive. Within that supportive element, there are a lot of people who tell me that they still won't forgive me, that I've done something that is unforgivable, that I'm barely part of the human race. And then there's another 30% that basically tell me to keep my mouth shut. It's threatening. I have gotten death threats. I continue to get large amounts of hate mail. And people that, you know, tell me that were I captured by the Iraqis, they would do far worse to me, which again may be true, but really has nothing to do with the standards that I'm trying to uphold here.
How has this affected you personally, participating in that interrogation?
It's really created sort of a hole in my life. I don't think I go more than a few minutes every day without thinking about it. Everything that I do in life now is I balance against Iraq. Iraq kind of infects every thought of every day, the interrogations I conducted, what I was involved in, what I saw. It's sort of a virus that infects every part of your life, and it's destructive.
Even though you only participated in one interrogation that you found reprehensible?
Yeah, and people have said, you know, you've only done it once, and you did such a small thing. You know, people try to console me that way, and I'm not sure how that's supposed to be consoling. It's ruined me. It's ruined many parts of my life, many parts of my thought process, and I'm sure it's a destructive force in a lot of people's lives.
What have you done in the 3 years since you've returned?
I quit my job as a contractor not long after that interrogation, and I went back to work for the government for a time as an intelligence analyst, and have since also resigned from that position. And I'm slated to head to a Princeton Theological Seminary this fall and pursue the ministry, something that in many ways was shaped because of my experience in Iraq, but also has been sort of a call in my life for most of my life.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's Eric Ferrer. He was an interrogator in Iraq in 2004, and he joined us from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Thank you.